An Indian tribe in Washington state wants to move its coastal village to higher ground. This comes after last month's Japanese earthquake underscored the dangers of living in a tsunami zone. But as the Northwest News Network's Tom Bonsi reports, it takes an act of Congress to expand a reservation.
The Quileute Indian Reservation is all of 1 square mile. It's surrounded on 3 sides by the lush rainforests of Olympic National Park and on the 4th side by the Pacific Ocean. Quileute elder Deanna Hobson says she loves living by the water.
The atmosphere I enjoy living by the ocean is sleeping with my window open to hear the sounds of the ocean.
But the roar of the surf has more ominous dimensions now. Like everyone else, Hobson watched those unforgettable images of destruction from the Japanese tsunami last month. She describes a recurring dream.
We're up at the cemetery road, and I look down, and I see all this water going by, and we're trying to retrieve or throw rope out into the water, and I take my dream seriously, you know, and dreaming something like that, to me, it's giving me a signal on something's drastic is going to happen.
The dream is not far off from what geologists say could happen here. Quileute leaders, including tribal chairwoman Benita Cleveland, want to give the roughly 300 people in the lower village the option to move uphill.
Number one priority is moving our children, the school children, up to higher ground. Our school is right on the ocean.
And so is the tribal senior center, several churches, and tribal headquarters. But there's a big problem. Cleveland points out the tribal village is already built out, right up to the edge of the tiny reservation. On the other side of the line is majestic Olympic National Park.
Back in the day, our ancestors moved along this land freely. They moved up and down this coast. Today, we can't do that.
Only Congress can adjust the boundaries of a national park. It's done it before. In December, lawmakers gave the nearby Ho Indian tribe a sliver of Olympic parkland. That tribe is now planning its move out of the tsunami zone. But the Quileutes are asking for much more land, about 785 acres of the national park, some of it designated wilderness. The tribe is seeking to enlist an unusual ally in its cause, the huge fan base of the Twilight vampire saga.
Don't get me upset.
In the story, the Quileute Reservation is supposedly home to fleet-footed werewolves. A Twitter feed and YouTube channel managed by the tribe tries to tell the real story.
The Quileute have been thrust into the international spotlight. But the reality of the Quileute people is far different from what is portrayed in the Twilight books and movies.
This part of the Washington coast is popular with Twilight tourists. Their welfare actually came up at a U.S. Senate hearing called to review the proposed land transfer. Washington's Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell describes wider public benefits.
Helping the Quileute tribe move their facilities 800 feet up and out of the tsunami zone is the primary purpose of this legislation. However, it will ensure visitors access to Second Beach, Rialto Beach, and preserve thousands of acres of Olympic National Park as wilderness.
There's no organized opposition, so the tribe's main challenge now is to keep the attention of the busy Congress long enough to get its bill passed. Then the next hurdle will be to find the money to relocate to higher ground on the Olympic Peninsula. For NPR News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
And now we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, something we do just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. And the way some people live now is amid exploding flashbulbs, the rapid-fire click of cameras. Now, you'd figure you'd see mobs of photographers surrounding celebrities on the streets of Manhattan or Hollywood, at least the streets where celebrities hang out. But paparazzi in Washington, D.C., it turns out that paparazzi are becoming a fact of life in D.C., at trendy restaurants, and in front of key venues, like this recent appearance by Charlie Sheen.
Charlie, how you doing, brother? Hey, Charlie.
Can I get some room?
Hey, Charlie.
Back.
Hey, Charlie, is D.C. winning?
In a piece titled In Your Face, Washington Post staff writer Annie Gowan says that the paparazzi are winning in D.C. of all places. And she joins us now from the studios at the Washington Post to tell us more about it. Annie, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, when you think Washington, D.C., and you think photography, I think you probably think, you know, shots of the Lincoln Memorial. I don't think people think of like shoving, sweating, you know, hordes of people trying to get shots of celebrities. So when did this all happen?
Well, a lot of the society photographers or the event photographers kind of date it to maybe 2 or 3 years ago. It's really the advent of, you know, sort of the globalization of the media. And the other part of it is that Washington is a lot more hip than it used to be. You know, there's a sexy young administration. There's a lot more celebrities are coming to town, as they will be this weekend for the White House Correspondents' Dinner, to walk the red carpet and also to advocate on the Hill. So it's kind of a dual thing that's going on, which explains sort of this outcropping of these new photographers.
You follow one paparazzo in particular, a man named Colin Drummond, and you talk about how he got his big break. Would you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, Colin is kind of an interesting guy. You know, he had a past. He was convicted on drug charges when he was during the 90s. But then later on in life, he shaped up and became a news photographer. But he started branching out into the celebrity realm in D.C. And in 2007, he covered the Howard University commencement where Oprah Winfrey was speaking. And he managed to get a few shots of her. And it wasn't until later on that he noticed that one of the shots sort of appeared, she was wearing flip-flop sandals, and it appeared that she had a sixth toe. And when he sent that up to his agency in New York, it just went viral on the web. And he made, I think, $40,000, and he still gets residuals from this wacky picture. And actually, Oprah doesn't really have a sixth toe. But nevertheless, the six-toed Oprah was a big moneymaker for Colin Drummond, who's really kind of the godfather of the DC paparazzi scene.
How does he figure out where these people are going to be so they can get these kinds of shots?
Right. So they have these guys, and there's only about a half a dozen of them. It's not like it is in L.A. yet, but they have a wide network of tipsters. So they have, you know, limo drivers that tell them stuff and hotel doormen and the concierges. And so that's kind of how they get their information.
And when you say tip them off, I assume it's a two-way, the tipping is a two-way street. Presumably they're not just giving them this information of the kindness of their hearts. They pay for it, right?
Right. I don't know how much Colin would pay for it, but he definitely, you know, gives out sports tickets and other kind of tokens of his esteem to his tipsters. But, you know, when we were following him, it was kind of a challenge because his day is, you know, he never knows where, you know, what he's going to hear from day to day. And at one point, you know, we were all set to follow him to Capitol Hill, and he got a tip that Jennifer Hudson, who's really hot right now, as you know, because of her new album and her weight loss, was coming into Dulles Airport. So he had to race off to Dulles Airport to get her, and he did, coming off the plane from Paris.
I think it is known that celebrities don't love this. They don't love, you know, going out to get a cup of coffee and having people in their flip-flops and having
right.
people following them. And that they're in certain cities, I think it people get used to it, even though they don't love it. Have there been any incidents in Washington, D.C. where a celebrity has just said, you know what, no, and reacted, you know,
There's a couple interesting ones. I mean, the famous one is when Shia LaBeouf was here filming Transformers last year, and there was a paparazzo named Mark Wilkins who was filming him, and he got angry and threw a cup of coffee at him and sort of walked away, and that was a famous incident. And then when that happened, that was kind of when people sort of started waking up around here to think, oh, we really do have paparazzis in Washington, D.C. But then another famous incident was when Colin Drummond, who we talked about earlier, and another paparazzo were chasing Russell Crowe, who was in town filming Body of Lies, and they were chasing him up the Clara Barton Parkway, which is a road that runs along the Potomac. And everybody knows that Russell Crowe doesn't like photographers. So he at one point just hopped out of his car, and they had some mountain bikes in the back of the car, and he jumped on his mountain bike and rode up the bike path to get away from them.
Well, there you go. That's one way to do it.
Yeah.
But before we let you go, you mentioned, you know, paparazzi chasing people. You know, that has a very checkered history. As you know, on the one hand, so you've got two competing things here in Washington, D.C. On the one hand, you've got there is a tradition of free speech here. There is a tradition of people being able to film and record and photograph, you know, in public places. On the other hand, you know, Princess Diana, you know, obviously the crash that killed her had many factors, including excessive speed and so forth. But there are those who say, well, part of the reason that they were driving so fast was to get away from the photographers. And I wondered mm-hmm. if there's any discussion in this city about, you know, regulating this conduct because of those concerns that sometimes it gets out of hand that, you know, people sometimes do get hurt in the fray.
At this point, it seems the only concerns that have legitimately been raised is it sort of out of place in the capital city? Is it too indecorous for this town? I think when it happened at the Kennedy Center Honors, which is another big event here, you know, people were kind of shocked by the shouting and the pushing and the shoving. But, you know, we spoke to Terry Gaynor, who's the Capitol Hill police chief, and he's now the sergeant at arms. But anyway, he was saying that, you know, it's really a small group at this point, and there's so much more infrastructure for security in place here than there are in other towns, just especially after 9/11. So it's not a big concern at this point.
Annie Gowan is a staff writer for The Washington Post. Her piece this week is called In Your Face. And if you'd like to read it in its entirety, and we hope you will, you can find a link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. Annie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. In today's down market, realtors are trying whatever they can to sell homes. They're using social media, spending hours staging homes. And as Caitlin Kenny of our Planet Money team reports, they're even trying to move properties by capitalizing on our national obsession with celebrity.
Here's something you don't expect to hear when a realtor is showing you a property they want you to buy.
This is where Dog Day Afternoon was filmed. To me, when you walk in, you can almost picture, like, this unit to me seems like this would be the vault where the money is.
This is realtor Celeste Moses of Perspective Properties. And the movie she's talking about is a 1975 film starring Al Pacino. It's about a gay man who robs a bank to pay for his partner's sex change. And, well, it doesn't go so smoothly. Here's a scene most people remember.
Get over there, will you? He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
Oh, God, I was going to kill him.
Erica! Erica! Will you? Erica!
Dog Day Afternoon is not a feel-good movie. It's dark and it's gritty. But that hasn't stopped Celeste from highlighting the film as she tries to sell this Brooklyn apartment. The opening line of her online ad is, "Be a part of Hollywood history." And in the section of the ad with all the photographs, you see the typical shots of the mantle and the kitchen, but there's also a photo of a man standing in front of a bank with policemen pointing guns at him.
It's kind of scary, but it's Al Pacino. It's not as if it's a strange person. And you look at it, you go, who the heck is that? And you say, oh, it's Al Pacino. What's this about? It's an attention getter.
The celebrity link to real estate gets out one way or another. If realtors don't promote it, the media does. Recently, in the Murray Hill neighborhood of New York City, an apartment in a building once owned by Bob Dylan sold for $842,000. New York Magazine featured the apartment in their Fame Slept Here section. But here's the strange part. The person who bought it couldn't have cared less about the Bob Dylan connection. In fact, he's in the middle of a gut renovation. And that raises the question, does the celebrity sales strategy work? To find out, I called out to the capital of celebrity real estate, Los Angeles. Broker Gary Gold has been selling homes in the area for the last 30 years. He's currently an executive vice president at Hilton, yes, that Hilton, and Highland Real Estate. Gold says just because a celebrity lived in a home or a movie was filmed there doesn't mean you can automatically jack up the price 10 or 20%. But the celebrity aura isn't worthless.
I currently have Ashton Kutcher's house for sale. And we did get a lot of exposure. And I probably had at least twice as many showings that I would have normally had. So if you get more exposure and more potential buyers see the property, you have a better opportunity to get more money.
Bottom line, a property associated with celebrity will attract more interest. And the more people that see that property, the better the chance of a bidding war. As for Celeste with the Dog Day Afternoon condo, she's got some new competition. A similar unit in the building recently went on sale for almost exactly the same price, although that listing makes no mention of Hollywood history or Al Pacino. Caitlin Kenny, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at libank.com.
And let's talk about this week's royal wedding now with Tina Brown. She is the editor of the Daily Beast and Newsweek, which have been giving extensive coverage to the royal wedding of William and Kate Middleton. And, of course, she's also author of the Diana Chronicles about Princess Diana. Tina, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here, Steve.
I don't know if you count as a royal watcher. Do you count as a royal watcher?
Well, I'm kind of an in-and-out royal watcher. You know, I did spend 2 years with Diana and interviewed about 300 people, so I feel pretty imbued with royal stuff.
And how does Kate Middleton compare to Diana, which is the question that so many people have been asking?
Well, just radically compares, actually. I mean, in every conceivable way. In fact, in some ways, you know, William chose her as being the un-Diana. Much though he loved his mother, she did provide a great deal of drama as well as love in his life. And so he was really looking for stability. So here's Kate, who is this middle-class girl who comes not from a pedigreed family as Diana did, who is very solid. She is as firm and calm and undrama-like as you could possibly imagine. And, of course, she's a woman now of nearly 30. So there's been this long trial period where he's really put it to the test of, can you stick this out? I mean, he did not want to have what happened to his father, which was a bride that hardly knew what she was getting into, and then a huge letdown as she realized how disastrous this was going to be for her.
How long have they known each other, William and Kate?
They've known each other since they were at St. Andrews University when they were students, when they were 20. You know, this is a long romance.
You know, one of the things that fascinates me about comparing these two brides, actually, is the time frame that each represents. One wedding was in 1981, 30 years ago. The other is in 2011. You have a writer in Newsweek this week talking about the way that Britain has changed in those 30 years.
Well, indeed, it's really quite dramatic when you look at it. I mean, actually, there are some things that are similar. You know, 2.5 million are out of work right now with the austerity cuts and the the budget slashes and all the economic austerity that's happening in England. There were actually the same amount of people exactly out of work at the time of Charles and Diana when Mrs. Thatcher came in and began her draconian moves.
Oh, there was a big recession then as well, right?
There was a big recession then. The difference then, of course, is that they had North Sea oil to bail them out. And Mrs. Thatcher hadn't yet kind of deregulated the financial institutions, and so there was about to be a boom. That is not going to happen again. There is, you know, the North Sea oil thing has really, that's peaked. And I don't think anybody thinks that deregulated banks are going to exactly help when they've been bailed out by, everybody in sight. So that's a big difference between these two eras. But there's also incredible just little details, like the fact that, you know, when Charles and Diana left for their honeymoon, they left on the Royal Yacht, which is now, in fact, a museum.
Hmm.
And it had 220 seamen and 20 officers, and just them as it crisscrossed the ocean, the Mediterranean. The Royal Yacht is now a museum. The Royal Train, which they traveled on together, hardly ever leaves the siding. You know, so much of British industry now is owned by foreigners, you know. Oil, as I say, is finite. Credit's finite. There's a big difference now in the Britain that you're seeing of Kate and William. And the great question is, will they be, in a way, the last royal couple, I think? That's on some people's minds.
What do you mean, the last royal couple? You were talking about abolishing the monarchy here?
Well, I think, you know, by the time, it really depends on the next sort of 20 years. I mean, I think that if William and Kate could come in faster, it would be way better for the monarchy. But Charles is not going to abdicate in any way. He has waited for this for so long. And he's also, I am told, really determined that Camilla will be queen. It's very interesting. The nation does not want Camilla to be queen. They don't dislike her, but they don't want her to be queen. They would like to skip to William and Kate. It's not going to happen. I mean, that requires a whole constitutional reorganization, and it would require Prince Charles to really want to make himself scarce, and he does not want to do that.
Meaning that there's going to be resistance here, but you think it's going to happen. I mean, the crown is going to be passed on here.
The crown will be passed on to Charles, and the great question is how patient the British people are going to be when he's king, and the expense and the lack of popularity of Charles are, you know, meet a head-on collision.
So Will and Kate here have got perhaps decades, certainly many years, before they're ever going to be king and queen. What are they supposed to do for that time, and what does the public expect of them?
Well, Kate primarily has to do one thing, which is produce a whole bunch of heirs, an heir and a spare and maybe a couple more. So she's going to be very focused, I think, on trying to have kids and doing charity work. William, of course, is still in the Air Force. He wants to, I think, very much continue with his life in that area. And, you know, I think that they're just going to try and lead a life that's worthy, that's increasing in its charitable, presence, and show that they are people who care as much as anything else, because that's really a very important thing for the monarchy right now, to show it cares. In that sense, that is Diana's legacy.
Tina Brown of the Daily Beast and Newsweek, always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
And she's also the author of the Diana Chronicles.